Michelle Flax is a clinical psychologist with a private practice in Toronto. More recently, Michelle, along with Dr. Stan Flax, has created a program to help those that have been diagnosed with prostate cancer. Her talk this evening is What Now? Coping with the diagnosis and treatment of prostate cancer. Please welcome Michelle Flax.
Hello, everybody. I was delighted to be invited to talk to you tonight, and very pleased to see so many faces, especially because there's an important hockey game on. I hope we can learn from one another tonight. You are already taking advantage of one of the most important coping strategies there is by being here, reaching out to others for support and using the resources that the community has to offer, few as they may be. You're all in this room tonight because something joins you together, and it's probably not the coffee, which I understand may not even be forthcoming tonight. You know, I can't presume to know what it is that you're going through, and even your partner can't really know exactly how it is for you. But hopefully in tonight's talk, I'll be able to give some pointers to help you make your way through all of this. My family is no stranger to prostate cancer. 12 years ago, my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and the first we knew of it was when he was told that his PSA was over 50 and he would need a biopsy. You know, I was married with children. I'd been out of the house for 15 years already, but I felt like someone much younger whose daddy was in trouble. I was confused. I didn't expect him to be ill. He was only 68 years old, and I really didn't know much about the ins and outs of prostate cancer at the time. Mostly I was anxious, but I felt I had to keep that under wraps because it wasn't fair on my father, who was, of course, even more anxious. Now, I have an unfair advantage in all of this since I'm married to a urologist, and everybody who's touched by prostate cancer should have a urologist in the family, but it doesn't always work that way. What was most helpful for me was that I came to understand the illness, the treatment, and the consequences much better. My father decided to go with the advice that was given, and he had a radical prostatectomy. You know, of course, it's a major operation, but my father did well on the whole. There were some post-op complications, which necessitated a further short stay in hospital, but it's all a pretty dim memory at this point. I'm pleased to report that we celebrated my father's 80th birthday this past June. Despite some lingering effects, which is more than a daughter should know about, he's a healthy, active man for whom his brush with cancer is only now a small part of his consciousness. His cancer episode, thankfully, has not interfered with his sense of vitality nor his ability to live life really fully. So 10 years later, or 2 years ago, my brother was diagnosed with prostate cancer at the age of 50. And this really scared me because I imagined that a cancer in someone that young must be fast and aggressive. Well, my brother might be the poster boy for radical prostatectomy. He recovered fast and with hardly a complication. You can imagine our relief, not to mention his. He claims that he's in a better position than he would have been because he doesn't have to get up at night to pee like many of his friends who are beginning to feel the effects of an enlarged prostate. I tell these stories as a way of talking to you about the effect of a diagnosis of prostate cancer on you and your loved ones. And I understand that you're in various stages of this process. Some might have just been diagnosed, and some of you have been treated and are well beyond the treatment and are living with the any lingering effects. No doubt that you've already been told that you have a good cancer. Well, that's an oxymoron if I ever heard one, you know, like government efficiency or deafening silence. I'm sure you don't feel lucky about having something so good. You're in the company of about 20,000 men in Canada who'll be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year. About 1 in 4 men who are diagnosed with cancer are diagnosed with prostate cancer. While the vast majority of prostate cancer sufferers survive the cancer, it's nonetheless a major life event that packs quite a punch. Our tendency generally is to try and keep things the same. But, you know, this impacts your life dramatically. And the diagnosis and treatment poses huge stresses in the lives of you and your loved ones. And some of these stresses can be ongoing and can pose difficulties that need to be coped with in as best a way as possible. I want you to take a moment and think back over the whole sequence of the diagnosis. Getting the news of the PSA, or having the doctor feel something abnormal on your prostate, waiting for the biopsy, waiting for the results, waiting for the doctor's appointment, long waits, meeting with your doctor, and decisions that you had to take. You've all been through quite a process. No one of you will have escaped the anxiety that goes along with all of this. For those of you who are in the whole process of this, you're doing time, and you can do hard time or easier time. And we'll talk about that, because when we talk about coping, the major aspect of coping that we're talking about is dealing with the anxiety. All right, so hard time and easier time. How do we talk about that? Hard time is when you spend a lot of your waking time doing the what-ifs. A lot of your mind space is occupied with the what-ifs. The problem with this is that you often have too little information to know how to answer that question, so all you're left with is worst-case scenarios. So some of you will have gone to the internet to find answers. I don't have to tell you that the internet can be quite a helpful tool, but in other circumstances can really raise anxiety rather than lower it. You'll have to find your own level of need for information through all of this. Some find it useful to know as much as possible, and some find it only anxiety provoking. I'm of the sort who likes to know everything, and I have to tolerate some of the anxiety that goes along with that. But, you know, and some people, quite understandably, don't want to know very much or need to kind of avoid thinking about it all except at those times where decisions are needed. So know what you need and try not to get any more information than you need at a particular time. Much of the worrying comes at night in the dark. I tell that my patients that worrying after dark is a no-no because things always look worse at night. Okay, so here are some things to help you do easier time for those of you who are dealing with the anxiety of all of this. The first is, distinguish between useful worrying and useless worrying. Useful worrying is worrying when there's something that leads to a decision or an action. Useless worrying is worrying without having anything you can do as a result. Okay, so for example, you need to look at what you do with such questions with what if I'm left unable to pee on my own, or what if I can't get it up afterwards? If you can come out of worrying by making a list for the next day, such as I need to call the doctor or I need to have a serious discussion with my wife, you've done some pretty useful thinking about this matter. So, that's the first one. Distinguish between useful worrying and useless worrying. Am I doing useful worrying is the first question you ask yourself. So if you find yourself with all this free-floating anxiety and not much to do about it, try buying time. One of the things that sometimes works is to make an appointment with yourself, you know, for the next day, say between 3 and 3:30, when you can do some really useless worrying, but it's time-limited at least. So that's the second one, delay. Delay worrying if you find you're doing some useless worrying. The third one, you know, sounds like it comes from California, which I'm sure it does, but it's called breathing. One of the things that happens, anxiety is a signal from our psyche that we're in danger in some way. It's our psyche trying to tell us, hey, heads up, buddy, we're in danger here. There's something to worry about. You know, and frankly, if we were not anxious, we wouldn't have survived this whole survival of the fittest, you know, lottery. We need anxiety, and it's a good thing. If you're walking across the road and a truck's bearing down on you, you better be a little anxious or you're not going to be no longer. So it's a kind of a, you know, it's a useful thing, anxiety, but we can be really hypervigilant. And when we're anxious, we don't distinguish between an internal danger and external danger. We can't distinguish between the truck that's coming and about to run us over or an internal danger, which is I may not be able to have erections, and what's that going to do with to my relationship, and what's that going to do to my sense of self? Those kinds of worries, is anxiety. When we're anxious, what happens physiologically is that our sympathetic nervous system kicks in. So you feel your heart beating faster, you feel yourself sweating, you can be a little dizzy and lightheaded, you can think you're having a heart attack, frankly. There's nothing more frightening than anxiety. And you can feel like you're going to die. It's no small matter, anxiety. I take it very, very seriously. We have no way of going into the sympathetic nervous system other than our breathing, because our breathing changes. We can't, for example, tell ourselves to stop sweating, you know, to change to the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calming system, or we can't make our hearts beat slower. What we can do is change our breathing. So it takes a bit of practice. You know, there I am on the 401, and it's frustrating, and I have to get somewhere and pick up the kids. And I've really now taught myself to change my breathing, to really watch that breathing, because when we're anxious, we breathe up here. And you can't get enough air to your brain. So what happens is that you get lightheaded, and you can't think well, and you're not in a good state when you're that anxious. What we need to do is breathe, and from a lower place, from here, you know, we have to have our tummies kind of going up. But really, the breath in is not the important thing, it's the breath out. If you can breathe out and count to about 7 and then kind of even do an extra couple of breaths, you'll find that you'll breathe in from a deeper place. And if you do that a few times, you'll find that it does change something. Well, if we've got a few minutes, I'm just going to do a little breathing exercise with you, if that's okay. If you're comfortable, sit back, relax, close your eyes if you want to, keep them open if you don't. And let's just concentrate on breathing just for a minute, okay? What I want you to do is to breathe out to the count of about 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And get a little extra breath out. And let's do that again, because you will have taken a breath in naturally. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And just keep doing that. Don't force anything in particular. You'll find it changes. It seems quite strange at first. But as you're breathing out, I want you to think about a place where you're really comfortable. You know, the temperature feels right, the setting is right, you're just yourself. Maybe it's on a dock at a cottage, maybe it's in your family room. Maybe it's kind of at work when you're feeling good about yourself and having accomplished something. Just choose a place that feels just good. Look at the colors around you in this thought, in this image. Feel the temperature on your skin. Just feel that good feeling. And what I want you to do now is to give yourself a word. It could be dock, or it could be, you know, family, it could be bed. It could be anything, just one word, just to describe that for yourself. Just a little code word. All right, now that's yours. That's your special word and your special place that you can go to. You can take that with you into any anxiety-provoking situations. Take that with you when you're going to the doctor, sitting in the waiting room. Do some breathing and do that visual little exercise there and get your special word. I can't do, you know, a whole session of that with you, but you'll find that if you practice that, if you really spend some time every time in the car or just sitting in the doctor's waiting room, just practice that before you go to bed. It's actually very relaxing to just practice going to your special place. And after a while, what you have is you've got a little code word that you can just say that to yourself, And physiologically, something begins to happen. You can kick in your parasympathetic nervous system just by saying the word and doing some breathing out. Okay, so that's one thing that you can do. Take some practice, and it's going to feel strange at first. See what you can do with that. So the first one was distinguish between your useful worrying, your useless worrying. The second one was delay, delay, delay. If you don't need to worry about a doctor's appointment until next week, because it is only next week, then why have, you know, a whole week of worry? Just have a day of worry. Delay till the day before, or to delay till the next day. The third one is try breathing during those times of terror. You wake up at night, put yourself in a relaxed state. Think of the place that you'd like to be best. The fourth one, do what you can to put the stuff in background by going on with regular life to the extent that you can. You know, at times this is all going to be foreground because you've got decisions to make, you've got to discuss things with family, you've got doctor's appointments, you're having a repeat PSA. All of these times are times for anxiety. And then you get through that as best you can, frankly. But no one can live on the edge of anxiety all the time. So you let yourself go through long periods of living as normal a life as possible. That's not denying it. That's helping you look after yourself. Sometimes we can't stop what I call emergency coping. That's the state in which you and your family are on high alert. Nothing else is a priority. This is a very difficult state for your body. If it goes on too long, you're in kind of an emergency coping all the time. You've got adrenaline rushing into your body all the time and your sympathetic nervous system is going like this. Well, that has effects on the body. You know, it's often a time, emergency coping, when you are pretty close with your spouse and your family, your kids pay attention to you for the first time in a long time. You know, it's quite tempting sometimes to stay in emergency coping. But in the long run, you do yourself more of a favor to go back to as normal a life as you can. All right, so number five. One of the best things you can do for yourself is talk to someone when you're anxious. You already know the people who are good to talk to. You know people who you can call up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, listen, buddy, I need to speak to you. It may not be the same person who you can call up and say, you know, I need $5,000, no questions asked. We have different people in our lives who fulfill different roles, and you know who it is that you can talk to who's not going to deny what it is that you're going through and say, ah, just a bump in the road, you'll be fine, or somebody who's going to say, you got cancer, what? Either of those two responses are going to kind of set up your own defenses. So you know who it is that you can talk to. Remember that you may be doing someone a favor, giving them something to do to help. We're so scared to impose on others, but you know, think of your closest friend and think of your closest friend going through something and you're not being able to do absolutely anything at all because he won't let you in, right? He won't let you do anything. You can be most fair by giving somebody something to do, such as talk to you or pick up your groceries or drive you to the doctor. You know, all of these things can be thought of as gifts that you give to somebody else to do. And if you're worried about friend fatigue, you know, when you kind of use up too many favors all at once, then spread the wealth around. This is a rainy day. If you're kind of part of this, the whole diagnosis and treatment of it, this is your rainy day. You know, the big C does entitle you to some specialness at this point. Number six I want to talk to you about is this. Listen up, men, this is especially for you. It's about the relationship with your own emotions. This is one time in your life where feelings really do matter. It helps to accept your feelings rather than hope they'll go away if you ignore them. No judgment. It's normal to feel scared or to feel really angry. And it's not easy feeling helpless. The research shows us that successful people usually believe that they make their luck, that they're not just subject to the fates or, you know, the playground of the gods. So sometimes this means when you get ill, you believe that there's something you must be able to do. And there is, you know, not ignoring it, going for treatment, complying with medical advice if it makes sense to you. looking after your body as best you can, all of this helps, but we do have to accept that we cannot impact everything, and then a sense of helplessness can set in. And you'll have lots of feelings about feeling helpless. Write it out, talk to a survivor, allow yourselves to get mad, it'll pass. You know, you're right, what's happened to you sucks. I mean, the alternative is worse, but it still sucks, right? So there are some, you know, just a few basic things that you can kind of do in terms of anxiety. But one of the more helpful feelings regarding feelings is to understand what underlies certain feelings. Since the primary feeling is often anxiety, let's look at anxiety more closely. There's no greater threat to ourselves than a physical threat to the body. And if, you know, this is your psyche saying, hey, we're in danger, you know, you listen up because there is really a danger. But sometimes we go into hypervigilance and it's difficult to calm ourselves down. And this is especially so when we have certain ideas about our cancer. I wonder if you could just take a minute and think about what your ideas are about why or you or your loved one got this cancer. Whatever comes to mind. Why did you get it? And I'd be very happy to discuss these kind of reasons with you, and we can take some time to do that if you'd like to. But let me go on to tell you a story about somebody who made some of his own ideas and how it impacted him. You see, the thing is, human beings are hardwired to make meaning of what happens to us. So we constantly make up theories to explain events. You know, some of you might have said to yourselves, just bad luck, right? And then clearly you believe that health is a matter of luck and what comes around, right? But some of you might have had a different answer for yourselves. Okay, how about I tell you the story of one of my patients and how his theories influenced his prostate cancer. So this is the story of a 55-year-old man who came to me because his marriage was breaking up, and he found the breakup to be agonizing, even though he was the one who initiated the whole breakup. So the thing is, he had fallen in love with a co-worker at his workplace. He did go ahead with the separation eventually, but he really suffered terribly through it. He felt he had done something that was morally wrong. He was afraid that he was giving in to his passions, to an irresponsible, uncontrollable force within him. Now, this man, when he was a teenager, had gone through a change of personality that he thought was essential. He felt at the time that he needed to put aside all his sexual urges and lusts. You know how it is in those years, there's testosterone surging. And he felt that these dangerous feelings would lead him into a dangerous place with women. He'd been humiliated by a girlfriend during his adolescence, and he was convinced that sexual wanting leads to suffering. So he pushed desire away, and he became a judgmental, righteous, moral man. We all know a few of those. He married a woman much like himself. Some years into the marriage, when the children were already teenagers, he found that he was dissatisfied with their rather sterile sex life. And to his dismay, he felt some of those urges and lusts that he had pushed down in his teenage years. He tried for a long time to deny what it was he was feeling, and during this time, he and his wife began to argue in a way that they had not before. He began to blame his wife for not getting particularly excited about sex, even though that was partially why he married her. So about this time, he began this relationship with this beautiful, sexy woman who returned his interest. This was very exciting to him because he'd never seen himself as, you know, someone who gets the gal. He was finally the one chosen. A short while into this extramarital affair, he began to feel exhausted and he had a pain in his testicles. When he was diagnosed with prostatitis, which is an inflammation of the prostate, he immediately concluded that it was the result of his increased sexual activity, and furthermore, that it was connected to his arrogance in thinking that he could have the desirable woman. He also felt that he was being punished for the affair that began while he was still married, though by this time he was now separated. So in the course of the treatment for prostatitis, a routine PSA was done. and it showed an abnormal PSA. And, well, you know what that's like. After anxiously considering the options, he decided to proceed with a radical prostatectomy. And this decision was not an easy one for him. While he felt it was the best option given his age, he was extremely afraid of the surgery and that it would leave him impotent. He dreamed that he had, in therapy, he would tell me about his dreams, and one of the dreams he told me about was that he dreamed that he had a wounded finger, and on retelling me this dream, he said, "Oh, that's me being scared because I'm afraid that my penis will be wounded." The patient was, in fact, left with erectile dysfunction as a result of the surgery. And his reaction to this outcome was interesting in that he was not surprised. He expected it. This was the fitting retribution for having an affair, he felt, for breaking up his marriage, for giving in to his passions. He made meaning of the outcome in the treatment in this way. To a large extent, he felt that it was his fault. He became depressed, and he felt hopeless about the future. He had few supports to help him through his illness because his lover left him, his wife was estranged, and his kids were angry at his decision to leave their mother. To a large extent, he stayed away from people because he felt bad about his actions. His ideas about why he got the cancer and why he was left with erectile dysfunction interfered in his coping with all the decisions he had to make in terms of treatments and supports. Through the therapy, he began to see how he felt so bad for feeling sexual desire in the first place, and how this blame interfered with his getting help with the erectile dysfunction. Over the months, he luckily began a relationship with a new, understanding woman who encouraged him to find ways of dealing with his erectile dysfunction, even though they were able to, of course, engage with each other sexually without intercourse. Eventually, he did seek help from his urologist, and while Viagra did not help him, he was able to use the triple mix injection to get an erection. You know, in a funny way, he admitted, he could use the injection because it involved a little self-punishment at the same time as giving him full sexual function. All right, well, each of you has your own story, your own fears and your ideas about the cancer, the effects of the treatment, and you know, these stories do influence things, even if we're not consciously aware of all of it. This fellow saw the cancer as a result of his actions, which to us, you know, listening to the story, doesn't seem all that reasonable, but the unconscious is really a force to be reckoned with. He had created a story that he was so tangled in, he couldn't make appropriate decisions that would help him get on until we were able to do some untangling together. Sometimes we're not aware at all of how we're making meaning of things, and sometimes we're plagued by guilt and anxieties. Sometimes it's even a relief. One of my patients explained that his life had always been so good, he knew he'd have to pay for it sometime to balance things out. He was just relieved that this balancing had now come and it was in a form that was unlikely to kill him. If possible, look carefully at the way you think about why you got this cancer. You may be surprised at some of the answers, and these answers may well influence how you get on with things and what you do with the treatment. You may need to work through your own story with someone who can help you do this, and don't hesitate to get the help if you need it or if it can be of help to you. Okay, I don't need to tell any of you that the greatest anxiety in prostate cancer, other than is this going to kill me, is the threat to your sexual health. More than 50% of those who have prostatectomies will be left with some erectile dysfunction, most of those who undergo hormone treatment as well. The most important thing you can do for yourself, and you've heard this before, I know that, but I'm going to say it again, is not to mistake the inability to get it up with the loss of your manhood. You know, let's think about what makes someone a man. You know, sexual prowess is only one small aspect. You know, when you ask women why they stay with their husbands, you get different answers, right? Any office ladies, why are you staying with your man? Anybody willing to say? Support? Go ahead at the back there. You love him? All right, thank you. Anyone else? You know, I've done this before and asked people, you know, why they stay. And it's not just because of the sex, let me tell you that. And it's also not just because, you know, this man is defined as a man by his sexual ability. Look, at the same time, some of you will have been left after treatment, you know, with partial erections or no ability to get erections at all. And it's a very difficult predicament. Relationships are like tapestries, hundreds of woven threads that can tell a story, you know, rich in detail and color. And for some couples, the sexual relationship can give this tapestry its aliveness, its vividness, its vivid colors. Its loss is often felt really deeply by both you and your partner. It's really important not to deny this loss. And not only for you, but for your spouse as well. You know, you get sick and wham-ho, her sexual life changes dramatically. Sometimes it takes a while before you can talk about this, especially if you're kind of walking on eggshells because you're afraid to talk about things that might upset the other. But talk you must, and the sooner the better. Laugh even. You know, couples who laugh together stay together. But if you can find the humor in the situation, risk a joke. It may not be well received at first, but you'll be setting the tone that you can talk about delicate matters. And once you can talk, you're on your way to finding out how much else you can do sexually and otherwise to keep the vividness and aliveness between you, or in rare circumstances, to create it anew. So, you know, this is one situation where the loss of function for one partner really affects the other partner in profound ways. Let me tell you the story of a couple I saw who had to face these kinds of issues, and we'll see how it affected them. Bob and Martha are a couple who've been married for 35 years. Martha is 59, while Bob is 69. The marriage has been somewhat tempestuous, and the couple separated 20 years ago for a period of 5 years. They have one daughter who is now married. Both partners work in a vehicle manufacturing plant. The main reason for the marital breakup was Martha's brief affair with her old boyfriend, which Bob discovered by tapping into her email. I must assure you that all these names are changed, and I preserve confidentiality here. Okay, so Bob discovered Martha's affair. It wasn't quite her email. I've just changed that. I emailed 20 years ago. It wasn't quite that, but I just see that in changing some of the details. It was her telephone answering service. Martha felt for years that Bob discounted her and her opinions and saw her affair as a sign of her dissatisfaction with her marriage. She had never been strongly or physically attracted to Bob, and she could no longer discount these feelings. The affair with her old boyfriend ended within months. Bob and Martha continued to see each other during their break and decided to come together again on the urging of their daughter. Bob was always sexually more interested in Martha than she in him, and many of the arguments centered around his perception that Martha did what she could to avoid sex. You know, beneath the arguments about sex lay all the hurt and bitterness of the breakup and reconciliation, which had really never been resolved. 6 years ago, Bob was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Because the cancer had spread beyond the prostate capsule, Bob had hormone therapy, Zoladex plus Casodex, which left him with no sexual desire and no ability to have erections. At the time of treatment, he also experienced some back pain, fatigue, and to his horror, hot flashes. The couple's sex life has completely dropped off. Initially, Bob and Martha came together to support each other through the crisis of diagnosis. They found themselves quite emotional and were joined in Toronto by their daughter and son-in-law for a couple of weeks after the diagnosis so that they could discuss the options. Both Bob and Martha felt that they had wasted so much time arguing that they really needed to re-examine their priorities and take pleasure in each other's continued presence. The anger, the hurt, the bitterness of the past difficulties between them were put aside in this crisis. They were able to remember the reasons they came together in the first place, and for a while the marriage flourished. Martha came to all Bob's medical appointments. This was very helpful to Bob in terms of the challenges of dealing with the medical system and having someone help him make his way through understanding what was happening to him. And you know what it's like. It's very hard to hear what the doctor is saying. When you're in that room, you need somebody with you to remember. The treatment was frightening at first because of the unknowns, but after a while, normal life seemed to return as the family got on with things. Slowly over time, Martha began to miss Bob wanting her sexually. Even though she had never wanted his sexual urgings, she missed the feeling of being attractive to him. She knew it wasn't personal, but she began to snipe at Bob out of her disappointment. Bob felt bewildered and betrayed, but he was unable to talk to Martha about his feelings. He felt his manhood was threatened by the loss of his libido and potency, and he needed Martha more than ever. He surprised himself by longing for the time of the diagnosis when the whole family pulled together. He began to withdraw, he began drinking more and more, which angered Martha even more, and she felt she was losing him in every way now. You know, and her recriminations increased. In therapy, we were able to bring out the feelings underlying Martha's angry recriminations and Bob's sullen withdrawal. And as the couple began to hear one another in a safe setting, they were able to see the wider context of their fights. Bob was surprised to learn that Martha missed his advances, and he felt relieved that he was still a man to Martha. Martha recognized that she expressed her disappointment as anger, and that this anger was alienating to Bob. She was surprised and gratified that Bob needed her. This couple still has a ways to go, but they've begun a process of recovery that will hopefully see them through. The impact on your sexual life is only one way your partner has been impacted. You know by now that when one person in the family is affected, others in the family are affected. There are many studies in psychology that show that illness in the family can be a cause or consequence of family dysfunction. Illness places stresses and strains on all members of the family. Sometimes the stress in the spouse can cause her to become ill unless the family finds a way to cope with it. Where there is illness in the family, there's often a marked increase in strained family relationships. You know, let me just give you a quick list of some of the ways in which a family can be impacted. You know, your partner can feel overprotective and worried about you being ill, and can feel her own depression and anger. One sometimes sees that children, even grown married children, act in unusual ways. You know, problems that can have been long-standing can be drawn into the whole illness scenarios. And sometimes families go back to old ways of functioning that are just quite dysfunctional. Sometimes family rituals or important occasions are affected, you know, because the person cannot fully participate. One fellow I know was terribly disappointed about having to miss his granddaughter's christening. One of the biggest things is time commitments. The treatment regimen, the hospital and the doctor visits, everything, you know, it takes its toll on both spouses. And this list just covers the surface. I've just run over the surface of what the kinds of problems there are. Overall, illness causes anxiety and stress in the marital partner as well as the ill partner. The extent of caregiving required, the duration of the illness, and the ill partner's distress all affect the spouse's stress level. Well, the good news in all of this is that the research shows that more serious illnesses also force couples into closer, more intense relationships. But sometimes that closeness can be so intense that couples can be in danger of giving up their individual identities for the sake of the couple identity. For example, your wife might be withdrawing from seeing her friends, or taking that art class because she feels she needs to be with you. And this kind of thing may be appropriate during the medical crisis, but you have to be careful that emergency coping is not extended to your usual coping style. One thing you should know, as the spouse of someone who's ill, that there's no real way to win this. I mean, what I mean is there's no way to be a perfect partner under these circumstances. Anxiety makes communication very difficult. People will often look to their partner to confirm their wellness rather than their sickness. So, you know, if you as a partner become overly concerned, your spouse can feel really smothered and feel like the future doesn't look too good. If you're too casual and unconcerned, the ill person doesn't feel that they're getting the support they need. You know, and finding that right balance can be really tricky. Because anxiety interferes with the hearing and processing of new information, couples need to discuss a new illness frequently and repeatedly. You talk about it. That's what you need to do. Except that you need to also be able to allow it to go into background for long periods and not have it dominate every conversation and everything that you do together. The most important thing that you can do for your spouse, for the ill person, is to normalize the life of an ill and talk to your spouse about those good parts. It really helps to protect your pre-illness relationship from this difficult situation. As well, it really helps you be there when they're going there, it's rough. You might find in return that your spouse is more emotionally present to you than in normal times. Now, there's a plus. Above all, the most important coping skill you have as a couple is to define this experience as our problem. The sharing of a negative life experience can be profoundly strengthening for a couple and for a relationship. If the ill person says, no, you know, this is my cross to bear, then what happens if you're doing that? You're saying, this is mine to deal with. Then your spouse gets shunted onto the side, and your spouse will get resentful. And if the non-ill person says, I feel for you, but ultimately this is your problem, you'll have to find the answers, you'll miss that opportunity to create a deeper relationship and to be really helpful to each other. So our problem, those words, our problem, will get you through a lot in your relationship. And this is especially important for those of you who face sexual challenges as a result of the illness and treatment. You're in this together. You know, the fact that you're all here tonight, with or without your partner, means that you've opened yourself up to ask questions, to work in a proactive way, and allow yourself the benefits of support. You're not alone in this. There are things to be done in facing this life crisis, and meeting together is one of them. But we've been told that a group setting doesn't always work for everyone. For questions that you can't ask in a group, for the issues that you're afraid to raise, sometimes even with your own partner, we've devised an individually tailored counseling program. And the team is my husband, Dr. Stan Flax, is a urologist, myself as the psychologist, and Tracy Hobbins, who is a registered nurse. We have a wonderful team. We have flyers here which we'll distribute. And feel free to ask Tracy and me any questions that you might have. This is not an easy time for any of you, and if we can be of help, let us know. And it seems to me that, as I say, being here, you are already doing a great deal for yourself. Okay, thank you. So perhaps we break for coffee? I'll be glad to take questions after the break.